Last month, on his return from the war in Gaza, the veteran presenter of the British independent Channel 4 News, John Snow, made a remarkable statement.
I'm back, and in the comfort of this studio, it's hard to imagine I was ever away.
He gave notice that objectivity and balance, the golden rule of British broadcasting and the most precious and embattled commodity in contemporary journalism, was not his aim. Bearing witness was.
What I never knew is what I know now, which is that those people who live in Gaza are mainly, but unbelievably young. The average age is 17. That means that about 250,000 are under 10. And you know, if you know any 10-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 4-year-olds, the idea in the looseness of a war zone, that you can control your children, that they won't be somewhere where they can be hit, is, you know, beyond any kind of imagination. You can't hope to control that. So that in a very densely packed urban area, if you decide to throw missiles, shells and the rest, then undoubtedly you will kill children. And that is what they're doing.
They are, of course, the Israeli army. As he knew would happen, Snow invited and got a torrent of both praise and abuse. He had, after all, implicitly proposed that British broadcast journalism should reflect its reporters' beliefs. Journalism on the long conflict between Israelis and Palestinians produces responses of high emotion, composed of fear, of anger, of accusations of racism and of anti-Semitism, the flinging about of words like Holocaust, Nazis, fascist, Islamofascist, with hideous abandon. It was the most contested coverage in the world, even before the web and social media multiplied interactivity and thus challenge and counter-challenge, insult and counter-insult, 100, even 1,000-fold. How this hottest of spots has been broadcast to British viewers and listeners over the past decades is the subject of this programme.
Jerusalem has long been the focal point of the still unsolved problem of Palestine. Although in times of comparative peace, Jews and Arabs live side by side and go about their business in the old city of Jerusalem with apparent calm, beneath the surface, bitter enmity has continued to smoulder for years.
That was Movietone News, a staple in cinemas right up to the 70s. A Hollywood musical-like take on the news which treated the stories it did like little feature films. Its coverage of Palestine in the years before Israel became a state, described as criminals, the armed Jewish guerrilla groups, dedicated to ridding the country of British soldiers. Groups like the Stern Gang and the Irgun used the terror tactics of bombs and assassinations against the army deployed to keep the peace in Palestine, for which the British then had the mandate.
The King David Hotel itself. It was in the wing on the right of the picture that the terrorists placed their explosive. And the result of the crime, the tragic scene, is like a serious incident during the Blitz. The hotel housed the British Army headquarters and the Palestine government offices, and casualties were very heavy. 65 deaths are reported, and there is little or no hope of survival for any of the 58 missing. Nearly 50 others were injured. The Jewish terrorist organization, Irgun Zvi Leumi, openly admitted responsibility for the bombing. Many arrests have been made. Leaders of the Jewish agency have expressed horror at the dastardly crime perpetrated by a gang of desperados.
But the media mood soon changed. When Israeli statehood was declared in 1948, the event was seen by the Western media as a triumph. The young men seen as pioneers, the terror gangs swiftly forgotten. The pictures in the clip you're about to hear show, in grainy black and white, young Jewish men leaving Marseille for Palestine, quitting a Europe which had subjected them to violence, to pogroms and the Holocaust, to create a space they could defend, call their own.
There is no longer any pretense at family immigration into Palestine. There are no old people aboard. Women are left behind. And the tough young men packing the rails to catch their last glimpse of peaceful France are soldiers.
They didn't come to an empty land. In Palestine, at the beginning of the tragic 20th century, there were 500,000 Arabs, Bedouin and Druze, greatly outnumbering the Jews. How then did the BBC see this other people back in 1949?
With the refugee problem of Hitler's Europe still an unhappy and recent memory, another of the same kind has been building up in Palestine, where nearly a million harmless Arab villagers have been made homeless as a result of war in the Holy Land. In various parts of Palestine and Transjordan, flimsy and insanitary settlements, made only out of scraps of wood, ragged canvas and pieces of tin, are now the only homes of the dispossessed.
Israel appears on screen in the late 1940s and 1950s as a new, thrusting, ambitious land with European values and systems brought by the settlers. The Arabs, conquered and driven out, are at least the potential enemy. David Cesarani, who's the research professor of Jewish history at Royal Holloway University in London, says that the reporting takes its tone and content from the prevailing geopolitics of the Middle East.
British coverage of the Middle East, the coverage of Israel during the mid-1950s, was overdetermined by the fear, the threat of Arab nationalism. That culminated in the collusion between Britain and France and Israel in 1956. And the fact that Britain got a bloody nose in the Suez affair in some ways reinforced the admiration for Israel. Israel became a strategic partner in the region for Britain and France. So it's no surprise that during that period, there was very little attention paid to Palestinian Arabs.
Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist and a professor of journalism, sees the same blindness to Palestinian issues and to the Palestinians themselves as Cesarani does.
There was some mention of the Palestinians, often mentioned as Arabs, who kind of like local natives. It was a very kind of a colonial, paternalistic coverage of, you know, some of the locals who were not happy and so on. But it was not any attempt to try to show equality or that there is a indigenous Palestinian national movement that was desiring to have its own state.
The prospect of a Palestinian state was in the 1950s discussed, but was given no solid basis. The State of Israel was a fact on the ground, and Palestinian hostility to it, most marked on its borders, was an ingrained feature of life. On these borders, the armed watchfulness of the Israeli farmer soldiers was treated by the BBC in 1954 with admiring sympathy, and without explanation of the reasons for their weapons.
With tension continuing along the frontiers of Israel, these latest pictures show how the farmers are constantly prepared for border incidents. Guns are carried by the young Israelis, all of them are under 20, in this new collective settlement of Nahal Oz, as they go about their daily work. The settlement is close to Egyptian territory near Gaza. On the perimeter of the farm, watchtowers are manned by armed guards who keep a continual lookout. Revolvers are worn by those actually at work in the fields. In this settlement, the corn is cut before it is fully ripe, in case it should be stolen or destroyed by marauders.
If the commentaries are one-sided, they're not wrong. The Israelis did bring a revolution to the land in scientifically planned agriculture, which made it the world's leading producer of citrus fruits, and technologies unseen on the land before in raising a standard of living, not just for the Jews, but for the Arabs who remained as well. The coverage often reached into the Bible for phrases to adequately describe this transformation. Here's Pathé News in 1956.
Haifa, the gateway to Israel, is a busy modern port with a two-way traffic in citrus fruits and dreams. The fruit goes out harvested by a young, vigorous nation. The dreams come in, brought in by the immigrants who arrive in increasing boatloads every week. For young and old, the dream is the same. A country of their own that most of them call the Promised Land.
The Promised Land, a land, the Old Testament tells us, promised to Moses by God. A claim to the land sanctified by scripture, modernized by the new Israelis.
Making the dream come true is a tough job. Reclaiming neglected land, making the orange groves flourish in place of the dry scrub. Conquering the desert with science and enthusiasm. It is a job so well worth doing that men of science have come from all parts of the world to centers like the Weizmann Institute to experiment and study.
The film and broadcast coverage gave a steadily upbeat account of brave endeavour bolstered by modern science and technology transforming a barren land, never, it seemed from the commentary, cultivated before. For broadcasters especially, less so for newspapers and magazines where context was fuller, nuance more possible, Palestinians were a threat or victims of an unexplained tragedy. Daoud Kutab once more.
Yes, you saw Palestinian victims, Palestinians becoming refugees, but they never spoke, they never had a voice. And so you have Palestinians who are basically voiceless, faceless, you know, living in tents and so on. So there is reference to Palestinian refugee status, but you don't feel that there is a nation or a nationhood or a national movement that is desiring their own state, their own country, their own voice.
The climax of this style of reporting, close to propaganda, was during and after the Six-Day War in 1967, where in a series of manoeuvres, still seen as exemplary, Israel's forces overwhelmed the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq and Syria in under a week. It was a feat of arms which drew forth a journalism which, whatever its protestations, didn't try to be objective. And in the cinema newsreel form, the music and commentary swells like a clip from the 1960 Hollywood film Exodus.
And Israel shall be a proverb among all peoples. Across the deserts of Sinai, a biblical prophecy comes to pass as the forces of Israel sweep on in an astonishing triumph of strategy. Inspired by Defense Minister Dayan, she took just over 50 hours to achieve her two main objectives. To reach the Gulf of Aqaba and lift the blockade, and leave the Egyptians shoeless in Gaza. However impartial one tries to be, one can only admire the efficiency of this extraordinary advance westwards, as well as the sword thrust to the east into Jordan.
The 1973 war wasn't like that. A surprise Arab attack led by Egypt on one side and Syria on the other had the Israelis reeling for a few days before they regrouped, pushed back the Syrians, then the Egyptians, and turned counterattack into a rout. BBC's Martin Bell was on the Sinai Peninsula when the Egyptian Third Army surrendered.
The fighting continued throughout the afternoon, and it was still going on when I asked the commander of the Israeli forces here, General Abraham Edan, which side had broken the ceasefire.
Well, the Egyptians broke it yesterday, at night and also in the morning. And we answered that at the beginning it was on a local base, and then it exploded. So we fought back and we improved out a little bit our tactical situation.
According to your information, what has happened now to their Third Army?
Well, I think that the Third Army is cut out, is surrounded. We know that the Third Army don't have enough ammunition, enough food. I think that his days are very little.
Is it still a fighting force?
Well, it still fights, but not an army anymore.
One-sided coverage wasn't wholly the Western media company's fault. They could embed with the Israelis, they couldn't with the Arab armies. David Cesarani sees the post-war coverage taking a new direction.
Well, I think that from 1948 until the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the template was small, plucky Israel, David versus the Arab Goliath. And I don't think that the media really appreciated the extent to which, after 1967, Israel was a regional superpower.
David Cesarani marks an important breakpoint. Plucky little Israel encountered a shift in perception, from little to large, from plucky to oppressive. Meanwhile, the Palestinians, especially a new generation, began to fashion their narrative for the Western media, as well as for themselves.
Palestinians found their voice. The PLO, led by Yasser Arafat, by a combination of terrorism that grabbed the headlines and by savvy media efforts, began to get its message across. So you have a Palestinian national movement that is better organized, more vocal, more effective, and a much more receptive audience for it amongst generations of young people who had grown up seeing Israel as a regional superpower, as a colonial power.
Anton LaGuardia, Middle East and Africa editor of The Economist, thinks that a consequence of the Six-Day War was that the Palestinians decided they had to fight their own battles in their own name, not wait for the Arab armies to liberate them.
And you get the development of radical Palestinian groups who start to hijack planes and hijack people. For example, the hostage-taking of Israeli athletes at Munich.
Well, the last deadline set by the terrorists expired 2 hours ago, but apparently negotiations between them and representatives of the federal, state and city authorities have continued.
A hostage-taking and a bungled rescue operation in September 1972 resulted in disaster. 11 Israeli Olympic athletes, as well as others, were killed. The Israel-Palestine conflict had spilled over into Europe, and the language of the time is clear. Western reporters were in no doubt that Palestinians were terrorists. Anton LaGuardia again.
So Palestinians, yes, burst into the consciousness of Westerners as Palestinians, but as a problem, as an uncomfortable problem that many people disliked and disrupted their lives because air travel suddenly became very unsafe.
A harsher situation emerged. Politics within Israel became more polarised, tougher. The main party of the right, Likud, broke the Labour hegemony in the 70s. It allowed or encouraged ever larger settlements on the West Bank, settlements which became and remained a major element in critical media coverage. Daoud Kutab.
The settlements and the settlement movement and reaction to it and opposition to it started to change the narrative. It was no longer the narrative of the Israelis waiting for, you know, Palestinians to make peace, but it was the Israelis digging in deeper and the occupation becoming more permanent.
On the 30th anniversary of the State of Israel in 1978, there's congratulation, but something of a new commitment to give the Palestinians a voice, to see and hear an individual speak. The BBC reporter here has visited an Israeli settlement. Then he goes to the nearby Arab village where he interviews a young woman activist, whom he names. She isn't merely a victim, but a person in her own right.
After one recent clash, the Palestinian writer Raimonda Tawil was imprisoned for alleged incitement. She summed up Arab reaction to the arrival of the settlers.
Well, it is the most difficult thing. We feel that our existence is being threatened every day. And that's why we should fight. We should fight to regain our identity, our nationhood. And this is the most difficult thing. The Israeli presence, the occupation, the settlements. They are taking from us everything, the lands. They are uprooting us from the lands by taking our lands and building settlements. It means by time our presence will not exist anymore here in this area.
Is there any way in which you could accept the Israeli government's proposals that there should be Arab self-rule on the West Bank, but with a military presence by the Israelis?
No, by any means. It can't be. It's impossible. It's occupation.
Israel's actions were no longer given a free pass, as those of a threatened state reacting in self-defence. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon in retaliation for an attempted assassination of the country's ambassador in London by a dissident Palestinian group. In the Sabra area of West Beirut and the adjacent Shatila refugee camp, Israeli units stood by as Lebanese Christian militia slaughtered several thousand Palestinians and Lebanese Shia. And this, too, was a major break. Lisa Goldman, co-founder of 972 magazine, a liberal online forum on matters Israeli, describes 1982 as a tipping point.
Israel's invasion of Lebanon, and particularly its bombardment of West Beirut, that was, I think, the beginning of a more critical coverage of Israel, certainly in the European and English language media.
The coverage, simply by being factual, was damning. And in time, the event and the protests internationally and within Israel forced the resignation of Ariel Sharon, then the defence minister. This is the then BBC's Middle East correspondent, Tim Llewellyn, on Sabra and Shatila, being interviewed by Gordon Clough for The World this weekend.
I suppose the big and awful question is whether the Israelis were acting in any sort of way in connivance with whoever did all this.
It's very difficult to know whether there was any connivance. All I can do is set out the facts as we know them, and that is that according to many correspondents and to senior Western European diplomatic sources who are eyewitnesses, the killing in these camps went on from around midday on Friday, well into the night of Friday, and in some cases was continuing early on the Saturday morning. The shooting must have been heard. The entry of the Christian militiamen into the camp must have been seen. The Israelis were only hundreds of yards away. They did nothing for a period of 24 hours while the Christian phalangists did their work inside these camps. There is evidence to suggest that the Israelis were taken by surprise, that in the end they started to intervene. But there was a long period of time while they stood by and did nothing. And we know from the positions that the Israelis had, they said, they stated clearly that they were around this camp. They were in control of all the main routes to the camp. And I know that Israeli tanks were less, in many cases, than 400 yards away from the places where these people were gunned down. So I think, you know, to use the words of one diplomat here, it was either criminal negligence, a sin of omission, or a sin of commission, and we just don't know.
Tim Llewellyn, no longer a BBC correspondent, is now an outspoken critic of his old employer, believing it to be influenced by what he terms the Jewish lobby, the corporation refusing to understand that Israel is an occupier and the Palestinians its victims. Like Lisa Goldman, historian David Cicerani sees 1982 as a watershed in media coverage and perceptions of Israel.
The invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and the siege of Beirut that went on and on and on was also covered intensively by the media and was on television every night. Israeli jets bombing Palestinian refugee camps. The protracted nature of that coverage, the powerful images, the apparent one-sidedness of the conflict was, I think, a turning point in media coverage because it created a new template. We went from Israel, the plucky little state, David versus Goliath, to the bullying regional superpower crushing relentlessly the Palestinian people, dispossessed refugees, turning all the might of a modern military force on people who could barely fight back. And I think that for a generation of people who watched those images, Israel was never the same again.
Just what that change was, we'll be back to tell you in a couple of minutes.
The BBC World Service.
Witness tells the story of great moments in world history.
On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots.
I don't think I actually felt fear. It was just, you don't know what to do.
Moments that were witnessed by real people.
The former Indian Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi, has been assassinated.
The crowd just froze for a brief second, and then everybody started to stampede and ran in all kinds of different directions.
Moments that shaped real lives.
I knew I was on borrowed time. That was obvious. So we just lived for the day.
History told by the people who were there.
I thought I had had a rendezvous with my destiny.
Witness on the BBC World Service every day.
This is the BBC World Service. I'm John Lloyd, and after the news, we'll continue with the story of how the Arab-Israeli conflict is reported and the role of social media.
Having all this information out there tends more to harden opinion because people just migrate toward the opinions that support their pre-existing views.
And I'll be asking why people who are neither Jew nor Arab get drawn into all this. That's in a couple of minutes after the news.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. The head of the US Armed Forces, General Martin Dempsey, says Islamic State militants have been damaged by an air campaign, but he's warned that air power alone will not be enough to defeat them. General Dempsey said that up to 15,000 fighters would be needed for land fighting in Syria. British fighter jets are poised to join the airstrikes in Iraq after MPs voted in favour of joining the campaign. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has warned that time is running out for negotiating a permanent agreement on his country's nuclear program. He said there would have to be courageous decisions if a deal were to be struck by the deadline of late November. The former Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, has arrived in court for the verdict in his retrial on charges of corruption and killing protesters during the 2011 uprising. Mr. Mubarak was found guilty of the charges in 2012 and sentenced to life in jail. But that ruling was overturned on a technicality, and correspondents say some key witnesses have since watered down their evidence. The president of the northern Spanish region of Catalonia is to make an official call for a Scottish-style vote on independence from Spain. That's in defiance of the central government, which plans to block any vote. The police in Hong Kong have cleared the city's government's headquarters after student demonstrators stormed the compound on Friday and refused to leave. The protesters want China's leaders to allow a fully free election for the city's next leader. And the Indonesian province of Aceh has passed a law banning gay sex with a punishment of 100 lashes from a cane for anyone found breaking the regulation. The same penalty will be applied to sex outside marriage. Homosexuality is not illegal in the rest of Indonesia, but Aceh was allowed to use its own legal code, Sharia law, in a deal to end conflict between the government and separatists a decade ago. BBC News.
I'm John Lloyd, and this is the Media and the Middle East. By the mid-1980s, the Palestinians on the West Bank had articulated their defiance and were increasingly ready to deploy it on the streets. At the end of 1987, an escalating campaign of disobedience began on the West Bank, which became known as the First Intifada, literally a shaking off. For the BBC, Margaret Gilmore described some of the worst of the clashes.
This has been one of the bloodiest days of the year-long intifada. Hours before American and PLO officials sat down to talks in Tunisia, at least five Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli soldiers and many more were injured. The trouble erupted at a funeral. Afterwards, there was widespread rioting.
It was in the 80s, an increasingly fraught time, when greater balance began to be built into the coverage. Yet still, Palestinians felt themselves to be lagging badly in both practical know-how and in influence. Dawood Kutab.
You know, one of the things that I discovered during this period was that we were totally impotent. We had no TV station, we had no TV cameraman, we had no soundman, we had very few people who spoke, were able to understand what the media needed and wanted and so on. And it actually took the Intifada to actually force us to start thinking in a much more strategic way of providing talent, providing creative support, and trying to be involved in creating the story about ourselves and not just being the subject. I remember in 1987 with the First Intifada, I introduced the first Palestinian to work for Reuters. To have a Palestinian speaking English and Arabic working out of West Jerusalem Reuters Bureau was a huge breakthrough.
The imbalance, Kutab believes, wasn't just in the technologies or experience of media. It was built into geography of the coverage, where the TV crews took up position, and into the ability or willingness of Western journalists to accord the same time and sympathy to both sides.
Basically, the images you got were always the same images of people demonstrating, women crying, screaming, saying they want a revenge for the killing of their son and daughter. And that was kind of the image that you got from the Palestinian side. But if, for example, an Israeli was killed, then the international crew would then do a big feature story, a human interest story, and they would take you to the family, they would introduce you to this kid who died and say, you know, this kid was a piano player and she was really going to become a major pianist. And, you know, you moved, you know, you felt kind of that, you know, this Israeli child. Whereas on the Palestinian story, it was always just images of faceless people, voiceless people.
Jeremy Bowen is the BBC's Middle East editor. He was sent to Jerusalem for a spell in 1991 as the First Intifada was well advanced. For the foreign correspondent, conflict is the stuff of stories destined for the front page or for the top of the news bulletin. Hence, his delight.
The foreign editor at the BBC at the time called me up and he said, look, Jeremy, I think you're ready for it. We need someone to fill in for a few weeks in Jerusalem. And I was excited, I was delighted because the tone of the assignment that he was giving me and the things he said gave me the impression, he said, you know, finally you're ready for this. I was 31, my career was growing, but now I was being offered the chance to go to report on the Arabs and the Israelis.
Why was it that Jeremy Bowen felt he had arrived? What was it about the Israeli conflict that was, for journalists and for their audience, so compelling, so hot? Anton LaGuardia of The Economist says there are many overlapping reasons for this particular conflict attracting the weight of attention that it does.
First of all, you have the story of the Bible, which is known to Jews, to Christians, and to Muslims. Everyone prays to Jerusalem, therefore everyone knows the stories of the Bible. I think another reason is in the early days of the State of Israel, it was seen as a great socialist project. So therefore, the socialists believed in Israel. People who were coming back to work the land, they were standing up to reactionary Arab kingdoms. Later on, I think it became wrapped up in the anti-colonial struggle when Western colonies were being liberated. And in a sense, Palestine is the last great anti-colonial struggle for people who see the world in that way. Then it became also wrapped up in the Cold War. Israel's victory over the Arabs, especially in 1967, was a very important moment in the Cold War between the West and the Soviet bloc. And I think in recent years, it is somehow also wrapped up in the whole perception of this deep conflict between the Western world, or Christendom, if you want to call it that, and the world of Islam.
History and religion are one thing, ease of living another. Tel Aviv has a fine beach and even finer weather.
You can basically cover the whole of the Holy Land without really worrying about someone kidnapping you. And accessibility is very important. You can get to anywhere you want to, really, within a day. And because there's a large number of correspondents based in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Gaza and the West Bank, any development tends to get reported quite intensely. Once you have journalists there, they will make news. Most Israelis and Palestinians will speak in quotes. They are aware that they are fighting each other with one hand and fighting a propaganda battle abroad with the other.
Lisa Goldman, on the liberal wing of the Jewish diaspora concerned with Israel, thinks the sheer amount of journalism is disproportionate and realizes its attraction for those unfavorably disposed to Jews.
I do think that Judeo-Christian and Muslim society are particularly fascinated by this conflict because it involves Jews and Muslims, and particularly because the Jews were always a stateless people, quite weak, and now they have this powerful state. And also it receives a lot of support from America, which is a country that has this Christian evangelical influence legislature. So all of these elements tend to attract attention. I do think sometimes, and I have noticed, that people who have a prejudice against Jews do tend to grab onto the coattails of anti-Israel movements. That doesn't mean that Israel's case improves because some of its opponents are anti-Semites.
The 90s was a time of hopes raised. A peace process begun in Oslo continued for some years, and hopes dashed. The peacemaking Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. An attempt by the US President Bill Clinton to get a deal on Palestinian statehood failed. The coverage and commentary, much of it supportive of the peace process, turned dark once more. And because coverage was influential on how Israel was seen in the world, it was scrutinized increasingly carefully. The closeness of the attention meant that the correspondent's work didn't end with the sign-off. Jeremy Bowen once more.
After a broadcast, sometimes the fax machine would whir into life and complaints would come in on that. And there would be phone calls sometimes, which we'd try to deal with. And of course, there'd be letters, almost all from supporters of Israel. 99%, I'd say, of the complaints we get were from supporters of Israel. Now, I don't think that was because supporters of the Palestinians were any keener on what we were doing necessarily. I think it was probably just because they weren't organized in the same sort of way. You know, I remember getting a complaint from what I imagine was a retired doctor in Florida. And I imagine he was quite old because he must have got a bit confused because he left attached to the email the original template email he had received from one of the lobbying groups saying, you need to send your email to these addresses. And he gave various addresses to the BBC, including mine. And this is what you need to say. You fill in these words here, here, and here. And He'd done all that, but he'd sent me the original as well, so I could just check his work.
Palestinians weren't geared to complain, as Israelis and the Jewish diaspora were. But when a complaint did come, it came from a high level, with threats.
I remember doing a television documentary called Arafat's Authority, which was pretty scathing about the human rights abuses that were going on at that time. You know, I remember interviewing a Hamas supporter in the British Commonwealth graveyard in Gaza, who'd had all his fingernails pulled out by Arafat's police. And then I received a letter from Arafat's Palestinian Authority threatening legal action, saying you must withdraw the program from any worldwide syndication, you must publish a grovelling apology, or we'll prosecute you, we'll sue you. So I passed this on to the BBC lawyers, who said, right, we'll write back to them and say, see you in court. And I did, effectively, in a polite way. Never heard another word about it from the Palestinians. So they did complain. They weren't happy with things, but it would be things like that, the odd letter from the Palestinian Authority.
Good evening. At least 12 Palestinians have been shot dead and over 300 injured in clashes with Israeli security forces. The violence was sparked off 3 days ago when the right-wing Israeli politician Ariel Sharon visited one of Islam's holiest sites in Jerusalem. The fighting spread through the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Hilary Anderson reports on the worst violence for 4 years.
Their own police couldn't hold them back. Palestinians were in a fury. Today, the whole West Bank exploded.
As the century turned, the second intifada broke out, and by now Palestinians were able to argue that they were the underdogs. David and Goliath had been Israel as David, the Palestinians with their tens of millions of Arab supporters, the Goliath. Here's Chris Doyle of CABU, the Council for Arab-British Understanding, founded in 1967 after the Six-Day War, to, quote, stand up for Arab and Palestinian rights, unquote, and to press for its version of fairness and balance.
Now, I think in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, it is a question of the Palestinians being David to the Israeli Goliath. And this is something also that is not always there in the framing of the coverage. The permanent reminder, as I believe, is necessary, that it is a question of an occupying power and an occupied people, and that the Palestinians have very, very few options. And you see that also within the whole media coverage. The Israeli government is able to, quite understandably, put huge resources into running a very sophisticated communication strategy. They have very clear messages about what their position on these crises are. But the Palestinians are fragmented, diasporized, they don't have that sort of resources or training, and they don't have embassies around the world in the way that the Israeli government has. So I think it's far harder for them. So I think this creates yet a further imbalance in how the conflict is perceived.
Many, many people, neither Jew nor Arab, are and have long been drawn into this conflict in a way they are to no other. What is it about this struggle that speaks to outsiders in the way it apparently does? Anton LaGuardia, with long experience of the region, locates some of the reason in political positioning.
To some extent, your position on Palestine defines your political position on other things, in part because of this question of colonialism, and the Palestinian struggle is seen as an anti-colonial struggle, in part because it is also a question of where you stand on America. Israel is America's very close ally. Israel cannot survive without American support, which is bipartisan. Therefore, if you are angry about America, if you think America is a force for instability in the world, you will be very critical of Israel as well. If you take the view that America is actually rather good for the world, is a force for democracy, it has defended freedom, then you're more likely, perhaps, to take a sympathetic view on Israel and its struggle to maintain its freedom.
Now, hear this.
A day will come when the area around the seaside hotel we use in Gaza will be flooded with tourists, and they'll marvel at the distant horrors of the past. It's happened on the Mediterranean before. Look at Sicily and Tunisia after the Second World War. And one day it will happen here. It just won't be any day soon. Tourists will find Gaza waiting. The half-finished building next door already has signs offering pizza and ice cream, even though there's no pizza and no ice cream, and no one to buy them anyway. Nature has certainly done its bit. Nowhere is evening more beautiful. The sun smears the surface of the sea with copper-coloured light, as though it had skidded across the waves and come to a halt on the horizon. And at about that time of day, that half-built building teems with life.
This is the beginning of a recent report broadcast by the BBC's Kevin Connolly on From Our Own Correspondent, something of a history lesson. If you want to hear the rest, you'll find it on the BBC website. We thought it would be illuminating to test what unfairness each side sees in the coverage, so we played that same dispatch to the leading representatives of two prominent British-based advocacy groups on Middle Eastern issues. First, Toby Green of the pro-Israeli group BICOM.
Even though this was obviously a report from the Gaza Strip and very much giving more of the perspective of how it feels from the Palestinian perspective, I could hear that the reporter was trying to be balanced. He referred to the suffering of Israelis in southern Israel. But as somebody that follows the Israeli-Palestinian conflict very closely, listening to him to recount the history and the context, all I can hear, of course, is what's being missed out. Two examples in particular came to mind. One was the deeper intentions and long-term goals of Hamas. We heard about its aim to lift the blockade, but we didn't hear about its long-term intention, which is the destruction of the State of Israel, and its methods, which are violence against Israeli civilians. Another example was we heard a sort of potted history of the Gaza Strip, but what we didn't hear is that Israel withdrew, in fact ended its occupation of the Gaza Strip in 2005, unilaterally removing all its settlements and its military forces. So, of course, it's almost impossible to give a comprehensive history in a short radio report, but what this illustrates is the difficulty of trying to convey the complexity of the issues through the media.
Then Chris Doyle of the pro-Arab Kabu listened to the same report.
One of the things I've always felt about Gaza that is almost routinely omitted is really how the Gaza Strip came into an existence, and indeed the refugee crisis. 70% of the population of Gaza are refugees. This all happened in 1948 to 1950. Yet Kevin didn't mention that. I think that personally is an omission, because Gaza without that would not be what it is today. It would have been the sort of wonderful Mediterranean seaside arena that he started his report off. But instead, it is hugely overcrowded, swarming with people, 500,000 which became further displaced during the conflict in July and August. I think the other thing I would say, in describing Gaza as potentially becoming that tourist destination, and indeed it would be lovely if it would, the reality, as the United Nations itself has reported in a very extensive report only 2 years ago, is that Gaza is going to be unlivable by 2020. In fact, there is very, very little chance it will become that. The water aquifer will be completely finished by 2016. And all of that calculation was done before the recent conflict. So I think it's actually somewhat grimmer, perhaps, than Kevin made out.
The most obvious fact about the reactions of the two men on opposite sides of the argument is that they make the same point. There's a lack of context. It's just that the context is entirely different. A common complaint from critics of the way the media cover wars like that in Gaza is that television, for decades the prime source of information for most people, privileges drama and thus depends on emotion rather than reason. It's unsurprising, so this argument goes, that people sympathise with the Palestinians when they see images of dead children, a point I put to Chris Doyle of Kabu.
It's always the case that, and particularly with the growth of television, now social media, that images really matter. What you can't get over, though, in images, is what it is like to live on the daily grind of occupation. This doesn't come over in television. What it's like every day to have to either go through a checkpoint or go miles around to get to your school because there's an Israeli settlement in the way, or to your hospital. Israeli spokesmen are fond of saying, we want quiet for quiet. But when rockets and other attacks on Israel cease, the occupation still goes on. And that regime of permits and demolitions and land confiscations continues. So the Palestinians never get to that period of quiet.
Yet perhaps what happens on TV is mattering less. The way in which the conflict is perceived has itself undergone a revolution. social media, held wrongly to be a decisive issue in the Arab Spring, have, less dramatically, shifted the balance of media power. Blogs, Facebook pages and tweets have now become commonplace. Lisa Goldman in New York, steeped in the ways of social media, identifies the Israeli war against the anti-Israeli group Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006 as a new kind of conflict.
At the time, I was writing for Global Voices Online covering Israel, and I wrote a blog post. I asked if this was the most blogged war. And I posited in my post that this was the first time in history that civilians in warring countries were able to communicate directly with no censor involved. It really caught the world's imagination, this idea of ordinary civilians carrying on a conversation while their respective militaries clashed right on their borders.
As the potential of Facebook and Twitter became better understood, the Israeli authorities built them into their communications. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, attempted to become a media organization as well.
The IDF, indeed, and the entire Israeli Foreign Ministry has an incredibly sophisticated setup. They have staff members from the Prime Minister's office, the Foreign Ministry, and the IDF spokesperson's office tweeting, Facebooking, blogging, uploading YouTube clips. You know, the army would supply these grainy black and white clips of surgical hits, in inverted commas, of targets in Gaza. And they were tweeting and basically all of this social media activity from the Israeli various branches of the Israeli government and military are going out in four languages, Hebrew, Arabic, French, and Russian. So what was really interesting for me was that despite the fact that the Israeli establishment, shall we say, had put together this massive, expensive, sophisticated social media presence, they didn't actually gain much popularity with the fence sitters or with the opposition. And I found that fascinating, because when the data analysis came out after the 2012 war, which, by the way, the Israeli army announced on Twitter, not in a press conference, it turned out that the hashtag that was most frequently used was Gaza under attack, or just Gaza. Not all of these hashtags that the Israeli army and the Israeli foreign ministry had used to tag their tweets. But even more interesting was that Hamas and their military branch, the Al-Qassam Brigade, were also tweeting in Hebrew and English and Arabic. And people did not tend to pick up Hamas or Al-Qassam Brigade tweets. They didn't tend to use their hashtags. They were really interested in sort of the safety and the well-being of ordinary civilians on the ground, but people were not cheering on Hamas. And that was true for the Arab world, the Arab Middle East, as well as for Europe and the rest of the world.
George Orr said the British wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill is better than war. For both Israelis and Palestinians, tweet is now an adjunct to war. It's a battle which the Israelis fear the Arabs, with their greater numbers and connection to the wider Muslim world, are now winning. During this year's Gaza war, the BBC World Service programme Trending, created to chart the way in which social media are changing our relationships, settled on the new communications war between Palestinians and Israelis as a frontline struggle for virtual supremacy, where the Palestinians were Goliath.
The exchange of fire between the Israeli army and Hamas in the Gaza Strip is often called asymmetric warfare, because Israeli firepower is pretty much a lot greater than the Palestinians, a difference reflected in casualty figures as well. But the social media war, May, it's actually the other way around, isn't it? The battle to get tweets and get your message out there. It's asymmetric, but the other way around.
It is. While the biggest pro-Israeli hashtag, Israel Under Fire, had around 150,000 tweets in the past week, mostly from Israel, US and Canada, the biggest pro-Gaza one, Pray for Gaza, had around 4.5 million tweets, mostly from users from Indonesia, Malaysia, UK and US.
So that's an interesting spread of countries on the pro-Palestinian hashtag. So not just bigger numbers, but particular countries like Indonesia are what's kind of changing the landscape.
Yes, I think Indonesia is an interesting one, because the use of social media is really growing there, but it also has the largest Muslim community there. And we're seeing many of these users online, which is really affecting the global trend here.
On the Israeli side, this is causing anxiety, because they fear that in that kind of landscape. Their point of view and the facts as they see them are being obscured. I spoke to Topaz. He's a 24-year-old Israeli who's about to be drafted for the army, and he's a heavy social media user.
A lot more people around the world who support the Palestinian side. And we are like in the downside of the media look. Maybe our army is stronger, but they have more people on the web. So we are afraid of losing the fight of the web. And we are struggling there, but trying to push back.
The online activists are behaving as civil society in a democracy should, pressing their case, exposing what are often prejudices, stereotypes, simple but sometimes major errors. Yet there's an echo chamber effect here, where each side, in its view of the media, produces a narrative of unfairness and listens only to it. Here's the blogger Lisa Goldman again.
What social media has primarily done is actually to polarize, to contribute to the polarization of opinion. You know, the articles that people share, the tweets that they retweet, the hashtags they use, the Facebook friends they choose are all predicated on their personal worldview. And having all this information out there tends more to harden opinion because people just migrate toward the opinions that support their pre-existing views.
Another Winston Churchill observation, less famous than George Orr, War, was that the quarrel in Ireland between Unionists and Nationalists, Protestants and Catholics, had remained intact and bitter through the greatest of wars in Europe, the First World War. He marvelled at what he called the integrity of their quarrel, untouched by the European cataclysm. In the same way, Jewish Israelis and Palestinians, with most Arabs, keep the integrity of their quarrel through the Cold War, through the end of the Cold War, through the Arab Spring, through collapse of the Arab Spring. Each has a tragedy to nurse, to exhibit, and to fear. I began in journalism covering the IRA campaign in Northern Ireland of the 70s, its bloodiest time. The continuing integrity of that quarrel was all too evident, yet in the end it abated. Those who cover Israel-Palestine know about the integrity of quarrels still better. It means that what is produced as news and analysis is bound to be picked over, certain to be pulled apart, doomed to be misunderstood, or sometimes worse, to be understood. And rightly, no one said that the journalism of life and death should be easy for the journalist or for the audience.
Today, the whole West Bank exploded.
Flags, Palestinian flags and pictures of Yasser Arafat.
That bogeyman, the archetypal terrorist.
This has been one of the bloodiest days of the year-long intifada.
Well, the last deadline set by the terrorists expired 2 hours ago.
One can only admire the efficiency of this extraordinary advance westward.
Nearly a million harmless Arab villagers have been...
Dastardly crime perpetrated by a gang of desperados.